Praise God, may you find him now. What Bob said so eloquently was, now isn't when I find God, it's where. If I'm going to find God, I'm going to have to be here, present in my own life. My God is the God of right now, the great I am, not I will be or I was. And here, now, this place, not this time, is where I have to find God. Powerful, powerful stuff. We're going to have an Ask It basket. We've got everything but the basket, I think, right? If somebody has a question, we used to say questions and answers, but we get stumped, so we promise questions and dumb looks, and maybe answers. So if you've got a question, if you want to write it down and just put it up here on the corner of this table, we'll get to them piecemeal, or we'll probably do a session tomorrow morning on those. And right now, what are we supposed to start again at 1:30? Is that what it says? So we're going to take an hour and 26-minute break, and we'll be here on time. Thanks. My name's Scott Lee, and I am an alcoholic. Let's open as we do with a few moments of silence. Use as you like. I'm going to ask God to join us again and bless us with open hearts. Serenity prayer. God.
Grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference.
I forgot my brain. If you have a cell phone, you may have used it over lunch. Once you get it out, everybody here wants to look at your cell phone. And while you have it out, why don't you look at it and make sure it's set on stun? Okay. A couple of observations as we move toward step four, which I claim is one of the easiest steps we have. It's a little bit on the long side. This is my passion right here, this part that we're going to cover. I heard this years ago, and I love it. Resentment is when I didn't get my will in the past. Anger and depression are when I'm not getting my will right now. And fear is the concern that I won't get my will in the future. And I hated that when I first heard it, because it was true. I was told this, too, and it meant a lot to me. All that garbage in my past that I'm scared of when I look at steps 4 and 9, all that garbage in my past is not who I am. That's who I'm not. Because if that's who I am, I'm still out there doing it. It doesn't make me sick to think about it. So what I was told was that that was who I was not. And what I would be taught here was how to stop doing who I'm not, how to repair the damage for doing who I'm not, how to receive the forgiveness for doing who I'm not, and who I really am would just kind of emerge from the ashes like the phoenix. When I got here, I'd been acting so long, pretending to be the man I thought you wanted me to be. That's what I did. When I wasn't drinking, I was acting all the time, pretending to be the man I think you want me to be just so I can hang out with you. That's what I do all the time. And by the time I got to you, I've been acting so long, I had no idea who I really was. I really didn't have the faintest notion. I knew a very, very few things about myself. I knew I was a raging heterosexual. I knew I liked to fly airplanes and shoot pool and fish. And that's about it. I really knew very little about myself. And I think it's okay not to know. It isn't okay not to be on a mission to find out. One of my experiences a few years ago, I got this urge to throw a pot. Not like my first wife, you know, the overhand. That's what they call it when they make one. On the potter's wheel with the clay and everything. I wanted to do that for a long time. And I finally ran across a lady in recovery that owned a pottery shop. And so I went to her shop one day, and we, you know, got the clay, and I did the thing, and I made a pot. And I don't want to do that anymore. And I think it's okay. I think that's how we find out, as we go try something. That's how I find out something doesn't work today, as I try it one more time and it doesn't work again, and I notice, which is the big piece. And so it's okay to try stuff. But I didn't have to buy a kiln and a wheel and 2,000 pounds of clay to find out. And so it's important to me that I continue to be on the mission to find out who I am. And part of that was about finding out who I'm not. That part of these steps are about digging poison out of my soul. I'm not trying to be poetic. That is precisely what this is about. And we're going to talk about that here in the next couple of minutes. This is a couple of quotations from my beloved back room. God forgives me for everything I ever did, and he loved me while I was doing it. My God got bigger the day that guy said that. And the other one is that I don't have the power to make a mistake so grievous that God can't turn it into something magnificent. I didn't say fix. That's who I am. That's who He is. I get confused about those things. What I wanted to do was to make a searchless and fearing moral inventory. And that's almost what it says. But not quite. We are now at the bottom of page 63 in the text. So the scene now is this man who I'm privileged to sponsor. He and I are just coming up off of our knees. And he has just said his third step prayer, having done everything else up to that point. My experience is like Bob. Somewhere between the third step prayer and the end of step nine, people tend to have a pretty big experience. Somewhere the door opens. Sometimes it's during the third step prayer, and I've seen them couldn't get up, crying. And I've seen it not happen until way into nine. Somewhere in there, typically something happens that opens the door. I don't have any expectations for where that might be. I always tell them before the third step prayer, I said, don't expect anything here. Do not go in there carrying expectations. The discussion rages in the fellowship as to when to do a four-step. And I've actually heard people say, don't do a four-step too soon, you may drink. I've never seen that. I've seen several thousand way too late. And I heard somebody say, do one step a year. I don't seem to be able to locate the page number on that one. The book is not specific about when to do step four. It actually makes two time references, and I believe in giving all the leeway that the book gives. And if it's going to give two time references, I believe the men I sponsor should be able to use either of those or anything that lies between them. Does that seem fair to you? Okay, so that's what we're going to do. So I have him begin reading at the bottom of page 63. He says, next. I say, whoa, time out. That's a time reference. So next would be as we come up off of our knees. Next we launch down on a course of vigorous action, the first step of which is a personal house cleaning, which many of us have never attempted. Our decision... All right, we talked about that. We cut away everything else. Our decision in step three was a vital. The word vital comes from the Latin vita, which means life. So vital means necessary to life. All right, so this is only for the ones that want to live. Everybody else can take another break. It says, though our decision was a vital and crucial step, it could have little permanent effect unless at once. Wait, that's a time reference. So the fourth step is either done next or at once or anywhere in between. Give them all the leeway the book gives them. Be glad to. Followed by a strenuous effort to face and be rid of. Isn't that interesting? Be rid of. The concept is so important, they're going to tell us twice on this page, be rid of. It is my experience then in writing, the writing portions of step four will get rid of time, paper, and ink. And none of those things are blocking me. So there must be things other than writing involved in step four. And I would propose, from my experience, that it is those things other than writing in step four that are the things that are life-changing. I'm not sure the writing has any therapeutic effect. But to me, step four is not about writing, although there's writing involved. It is those other things that we're going to talk about. Continuing at the top of page 64, to face and be rid of the things in ourselves which had been blocking us. So there's the good news again. I'm the problem. Our liquor was but a symptom, so we had to get down to causes and conditions. Therefore, we start up on a personal inventory. This is step four. A business which takes no regular inventory usually goes broke. The businesses that I deal with do a computer update every night. To me, that's the evening half of step 11. But once a year, sometimes twice, but always once a year, they do a full teardown inventory. I mean, it's required for tax purposes. And that's the reference the book makes. And in 22 years, I think I've done 17 or 18 four steps. The last one I did on an airplane in about 30 minutes. Then if I stay clean and do all the things that we do, the other stuff doesn't tend to stack up, but I do need to sweep. I discovered on my eighth four step resentments that were over 25 years old, and I had been thorough on the previous seven. So it's important to me to continue to do this work. And I know some people that say you do the first nine steps once, you stay sober 10, 11, 12. If that's what your sponsor wants you to do, I'm good with it. That suits me just fine. But I found major resentments over 25 years old on my eighth one. And I like this reference here. A business which takes no regular inventory usually goes broke. Taking a commercial inventory is a fact-finding and a fact-facing process, an effort to discover the truth about the stock and trade. One object is to disclose damaged or unsaleable goods to get rid of. They told me twice on this page we're going to get rid of. Them promptly and without regret. If the owner of the business be successful, he cannot fool himself about values. We did exactly the same thing with our lives. We took stock honestly. First, we searched out the flaws in our makeup which caused our failure. There's a good news one more time, and here it comes again. Being convinced itself, manifested in various ways, was what had defeated us, we considered its common manifestations. Now, I've cheated and looked ahead, and this is my experience with step four. The manifestations of self that we inventory in step four are resentment, fear, and sexual misconduct. I claim there's not a sex inventory in this book. We don't inventory the bright side. I don't find the instruction in here that says, all right, at this point, let's inventory all the things from the sexual arena that you did that you thought were right and good. It's not in here. And I don't like the idea of sex having a bad name. It's my favorite toy. And you can relate. I know you can. And I don't think God was having a bad day when he came up with the idea either. So I don't like it having a bad name. And so I don't want to call it a sex inventory because I don't think it is. We inventory only the dark side of that. And there is a dark side, but there is another side. The format that the book lays out is a series of lists, observations, and prayers. It has been my experience that the writing has very little effect. The observations, not what you happen to notice while you were writing, but the observations specifically called for and the prayers I find to be life-changing. And that's what we're here to talk about. So what we're going to do now is we're going to start searching for instructions. And I count somewhere around 30 in here, taken one at a time. I have people ask me sometimes what I think about writing a autobiography. And I think it's a great idea. I hope you take a four-step also, because that will change your life. I don't know that the autobiography will. When I first read this, I drew a line under it and I added it all up and it said, write the story of your life and make sure you include every rotten thing you ever did. Doesn't say that at all. As a matter of fact, some of the worst things in my inventory aren't on here. They aren't called for in step four. They were called for in step five. So I'm going to take this very literally, and I want you to know too that I'm not near as hung up on format as I appear to be. I think content is the critical piece. Content is what matters. So we're going to look for instructions. Bottom of page 64. Resentment is the number one offender. I wonder how important that is. It destroys more alcoholics than anything else. From it stem all forms of spiritual disease. We've been not only mentally and physically ill, we've been spiritually sick. That's the first indictment of resentment. Two pages later, we're going to find another one. It says, when the spiritual malady is overcome, we straighten out mentally and physically. It makes me think the spiritual one must be the most important. It seems that if I can get that one fixed, everything else takes care of itself. It says, in dealing with resentments, we set them on paper. To me, that's a general description. They're going to tell me exactly how to set it on paper. It says, we listed people, institutions, or principles with whom we are angry. A list is a series of words and phrases that run down a page. I don't think I've ever seen a list that ran across a page. And so what I need before I find direction two is to complete direction one. I always want to take too big a bite. I want to do it all at once. No. No. What it calls for here is a list. Now, and I usually at this point, I like to have a lot of fun. I say, now you're probably wondering what color paper you should use and what color ink. Were you wondering that? And about half of them will say, yeah, because that's what they think I want them to say. And on page 67, paragraph begins with the word notice. Near the bottom, you count up four lines above that. It says, when we saw our faults, we listed them and placed them for us in black and white. That's not very specific. That doesn't say black ink and white paper. That could easily be black paper and white ink. Could be either one. And Bob shakes his head when I do this part of it, and I'm good with it. But I like to take it that literally. Because the first time I let myself off the hook on something that's in here, I could be letting me off on the hook of the thing that would have saved my life. So I require the men I sponsor to either use black ink or pencil on white paper or white pen on black paper. And I had a guy, he was actually a city cop, and he'd never believe this would work for him. He went down to the art store and bought an inch thick of black paper and two pens wrote white ink. I'm good with that. I'm good with that. Yeah, what an attitude. Yeah. And he's carrying a 15-year chip right now. Yeah. Yeah. And what I recommend, because I think it's really easy, is a spiral notebook. And what you do is you open up, and on the inside cover here, it says, this is my four-step, put it down. If I find you with it, there'll be hell to pay. Something subtle, like that. And then we turn the page, turn one page, and write a 1 above the margin on the left-hand page, a 2 above the center of the left-hand page, and the 3 and the 4 split the right-hand page. And the reason is because we're going to do a 4-column inventory. That's the way I lay it out. And we don't need to know what directions for 2 and 3 are until we've completed the first one. At this point, I'd like to make a couple of more observations. There are 68 hours in a week. If he's got a 40-hour-a-week job and a 30-minute commute, that's 45 hours. If he sleeps 8 hours a night, that's 56 more. If he spends 15 hours a week going to meetings, that's 30 minutes of drive time on either side and a one-hour meeting plus a little change. 3 hours a week on recreation, a round of golf, something like that, a little tennis. 2 hours mowing the lawn and doing his melon list. You know the melon list, honey, do this, honey, do that. 5 hours reading spiritual literature. I require him to read 2 pages a day in the big book. I do it myself. I read mine this morning. 3 hours a week bathing and shaving, etc. 4 hours a week, a date with your wife, maybe coaching a little league team, something like that. 5 hours a week on the telephone with me and some other men whose names I'm going to give you, because I want you talking to people who know how this thing works. 12 hours a week, cooking and eating. 1 hour a week, shopping for groceries, clothes, getting a haircut. 5 hours a week in prayer and meditation. I'm going to give you 9 hours a week on TV. That's 3 ball games. That's enough. That adds up to 165 hours. There are only 168 hours in a week. He's got 3 hours left. I want half. I sincerely believe that recovery should not have a negative impact on any other aspect of my life. It should be inconvenient at times. Shouldn't have a negative aspect. This should not take you from your family or your job or any of the other things that are important to you. Now, I still sponsor the guy, but his life has changed since then. His wife had a fabulous job. He was a stay-at-home dad with a one-year-old baby when we got to this. And his son slept from 1 to 3 every afternoon, 5 days a week. I want 10 hours from him. I don't see why he can't use those nap times 5 days a week to work on his four-step. And he did. Another guy has got a wife and 5 kids and 2.5 jobs. I don't think he can give me an hour and a half. So we want to talk about this. I'm a really reasonable man, but only on the front end. I'm a tiger on the back. Don't tell me later why you couldn't do it. Tell me on the front end why you can't do it. Let's talk. The other thing I like to tell them, too, is that you're not going to do the perfect four-step. Most people, I think, when they set out to do step four, first thing is they give themselves the assignment to complete step four. If you do that, you're in perfect position to hate yourself while you're in progress. I think we hated ourselves long enough. Far, far easier for you and your sponsor to agree on how much time you're going to spend each week. And then you spend that time on it, and you can feel good about yourself while you're in progress. I think it's a much, much better approach. I think it's important also that you're not going to do the perfect four-step, but I tell them that. We are not saving a special alcove in Akron at the AA Hall of Fame for your four-step. As a matter of fact, our home group does not give a trophy every year for the best four-step, and this is the trophy that you are not going to get. If you can't see it from there, it says four-step trophy never awarded. All right? Because it isn't. Because you are not going to do a four-step worthy of a trophy. Because if I have to do it perfectly, I can't do it at all. We're not going to do it perfectly. That's not the assignment. And so what I like to do is to have them, and this is just a rule of thumb. It varies for every individual. This is just sort of a rough outline idea of an approach. I want him to call me every Sunday, and I want him to leave on my answering machine when he's going to work on his four-step this week. And Monday, Wednesday, and Friday does not get it. Monday from 8 p.m. to 8:30 p.m., that gets it. I want a time on that. And make an appointment with yourself. Oh, and you forgot your son had the little league game on Saturday afternoon at 2, and so you had to delay your four-step until 9 that night? No problem. I don't even need a phone call on that. But like anything else that's important on your calendar, it's not subject to cancellation. It might move a little, but it's not subject to cancellation. So let's get in progress with this thing. On those 30-minute segments, I like them to use the first 5 minutes in prayer and meditation. Pray anything you want to, but include clarity of mind and the courage to write it down. And then, so what we have now, going back to the first instruction, it says we listed people, institutions, or principles with whom we are angry. A list runs down a page. So here's what it looks like. So you write a name. You've done your 5 minutes of prayer and meditation. Phone's turned off. Wife's not going to bother you. She knows where you are. Write a name, skip a line. Write a name, skip a line. Just as fast as you can think of anyone who has ever made you angry. And on your first one, even if you're sure you've already forgiven them. If you're absolutely sure you've forgiven them, great. Write it down. Write a name, skip a line. Write a name, skip a line. When you get to the bottom, you have to turn the page because we've already got a 3 and a 4 up here for the additional columns. Turn the page and continue. For those who have cheated and looked ahead and realized that the second instruction is going to have to do with what they did and you're planning to leave about 8 pages for your father, the answer to the question is write a name, skip a line. Write a name, skip a line. We're going to talk about why in a couple of minutes. It's really, really important, I believe. And I do this just in minute detail, and I apologize for that, just what I do. When you get to where you can't think, I could just puke them, just as fast as you can. Anybody anywhere that ever made you mad. And when those slow down, when you can sit for 30 seconds and not think of one, let's take a look at the bottom of page 65. It says, we went back through our lives. So that indicates that I start with today. All right? I'm living on Meadow Drive. I'm married to Miss Linda. And I got these guys in my life, and the back room is my home group, and I work for this company, etc. But 14 years ago, I lived in the other place, and I was married to, and worked for them, and so on. And then before that, I lived in Louisville, Kentucky, and I worked for them. And before that, I actually lived in Plantation, Florida. And before that, I was in the Air Force, and I was stationed at Travis. And before that, I was stationed in Vietnam. And I go back through my life in reverse chronology, exploring for anyone or anything that has ever made me angry. And the rule is, when in doubt, write it out. If you're not sure, put it down. When we get through this list a little bit further, we'll discover whether it was actually a resentment or not. If it turns out not to have been one, you will have given up a minute amount of time, a tiny bit of ink, and a little bit of paper. If it turns out to be one and you didn't write it down, it will destroy you. So your choice, little time, little paper, little ink, or destroyed. Which one of those penalties do you like better? So the rule is, when in doubt, write it out. When he gets to his earliest memory, we are finished with step one, or with the first portion. Is it complete? No. It's not supposed to be. It's supposed to be what he can get for now. He and God are working on that? Great. At that point, I ask him to carry a pencil or a pen and a piece of paper all the time, because he's going to be walking through the grocery store. He's going to see the cantaloupe. So that sucker's head looks just exactly. Just write it down. We'll add it to the end. Keep it coming. We now look for direction two, bottom of page 64. We asked ourselves why we were angry. Let's take a look at the example on page 65 under the cause. Actually, it says, I'm resentful at Mr. Brown, and then the cause. And then under the cause, this is what it says. His attention to my wife, told my wife of my mistress, Brown may get my job at the office. Start with office and count backwards the words under cause. Let me know how many you get. Somebody got a count? 19. The reason I had you go backwards, if you go forward, you miss of. 19 words. Let's take a look at what Mr. Brown has done here. He is messing with this guy's wife. Has told his wife about his girlfriend and is trying to get him fired. He got 19 words. As far as I'm concerned, 19 is the limit. And if you have done it this way, you will have a name and you'll have the room from the margin over to the spiral and the whole line below it on which you can write 19 words or less. It's a summary. All right, it doesn't start out and say it was a rainy Wednesday afternoon. Mm-mm. No, we're not starting there. And no, you can't list somebody's name more than once. Nice try. Because doing those kinds of things has a tendency to feed these resentments, and we're not trying to feed them. We're trying to excise them. We're trying to dig them out of here. That's what this whole thing is about. 19 words. Now, I always tell them this. You may have somebody that's done more than that to you. If you have, call me, and we'll negotiate whether or not you can write the 20th word. I'd be glad to talk about it. I'll tell you, I've never given up the 20th word. I've never been called. You wouldn't call me, would you? No, they wouldn't either. No. Yeah, because it says things like, on Dad, he pushed me down so hard that at 63 years old, I still have trouble with authority figures sometimes. That's true. That's my story. That next little girl's name left me for another guy. It says, screwed me in a business deal. Left me for another guy. Screwed me in a business deal. Left me for another guy. It is a bit redundant in places. And so, once again, we're going to work down the page. Having now seen the first two directions, you're going to have a terrible need, if you've never done one of these, to work across the page, because you're American. And we work left to right. We don't work top to bottom. I like to recommend you don't do that. There are two reasons. The best reason is the book said list. and lists run down the page. The second reason is it's been my experience that if you work across the page, it'll tend to make that resentment flare. If you work down the page, it's so much more analytical. And it's a summary, just really brief stuff. Top of page 65. On our grudge list opposite each name, we set our injuries. Was it our self-esteem, security, ambitions, personal or sex relations which had been interfered with? So it's a five-part multiple choice. And some are only going to get one entry. Some will get all five. Some get two or three. Some you won't be able to figure out. Call me. I'll help you see why it was self-esteem. It seems like it always is on the new guys. On my first, I don't know, 6 or 8 or 10 of these things, self-esteem got most of the ink. The last two, it's been security. I was astounded because I only got like 6 or 7 resentments. I didn't have that many. But when I got to column 3, I was amazed that it was mostly security. So that something has changed about me. And I just observed that. Bottom of page 65. So now we've got column 3, five-part multiple choice. We don't need any additional entries. We appreciate your analysis. Maybe we'll talk about it later. Probably not. Bottom of page 65, we went back through our lives. Nothing counted but thoroughness and honesty. At this point, I say, have you been thorough? Best you could do? Been honest? Well, good. When we were finished, we considered it carefully. That's not a direction. That's a general description. They're going to tell me how to consider it. And I think the directions that fall between the third and fourth column of the resentment inventory are the ones we most easily miss and are some of the very most powerful in this literature. If you're busy writing a four-step, if your mind says four-step writing, writing is four-step is writing, you will miss these. And you will miss the part that will have changed your life. You will miss the chance to dig the poison out of your soul. This is the part that I have the passion for. I think I've seen more lives change here, probably this and in making some of the harder amends, than everywhere else combined. Bottom of 65. The first thing apparent was that this world and people were often quite wrong. Now, I know you've already spotted that. You've been on bar stools for 20 years with the other great philosophers of our era talking, right, about the wrongs that others have done. So I don't want to spend a lot of time on this one. Conclude others were wrong as far as most of us ever got. The usual outcome was that people continued wrong us and we stayed sore. Has that been your experience? Sometimes it was remorse and we were sore at ourselves. I hated that. The more we fought and tried to have our own way, the worse matters got. As in war, the victor only seemed to win. Our moments of triumph were short-lived. Here we go. It is plain that a life which includes deep resentment leads only to futility and unhappiness. I asked them as we start this process, do you want, what the people who wrote this book had was productive, happy, peaceful sobriety. Is that what you want? Then if it is, when they say they wrote something, I'm going to expect you to write it. If they say they prayed something, I'll expect you to pray it. If they say that they observed something, I'll ask you to try to observe it. You may or not be able to, but you will try it. And here's an observation that they made. It's plain that a life which includes deep resentment leads only to futility and unhappiness. Is that plain to you? Have you ever known anyone who was happy, joyous, free, and full of resentment? I never have. So let's observe that. This is important. It says, to the precise extent that we permit these, do we squander the hours that might have been worthwhile? Did you ever lay awake at night and hate them when you should have been sleeping? Did you ever sit in class and plan what you were going to do to them instead of listening? Is that striking anybody? Okay. Did you squander hours that might have been worthwhile that way? Okay, so this one's true for you also. But with the alcoholic, whose hope? Oh, you want to know what your hope is? Is the maintenance and growth of a spiritual experience. Growth means that what I've already got is insufficient. Growth means that Scott's 2005 program might not be good enough to keep him sober in 2006. That I must continue to try to stay in the growth mode. Maintenance, I believe, means two things. Maintenance means I can't afford to lose anything I've already got. It also means I must maintenance my spiritual condition or spiritual experience in the same sense that I maintenance my vehicle. I rotate the tires. I got the right pressure in them. I vacuum it. I clean it out. I change the oil. I maintenance my spiritual condition. I open my mornings with prayer, inviting God into my life. I meditate. I read 2 pages a day in the text. I read some other non-conference approved spiritual literature. If you ask me in private, I'll tell you. Here it's inappropriate to say. I sponsor some guys. I got a sponsor. I've got a home group. I take meetings into jails and treatment centers. I let people in traffic. You put your blinker around near me, I'll let you in. It's one of the most spiritual things I do because I am a red-eyed Class A driver, and I'll slow down to let you in. It's a very spiritual thing for me. I'm married to a fabulous woman. I act like it all the time. That's how I maintenance my spiritual condition. That's how I do that. It says this business of resentment is infinitely grave. Infinitely grave. Oh, I think we just threatened your life. I think we're going to do it a lot on this page. That was one. We found that it is fatal. That's two. I'm going to tell a story. I went to the man that took me through these steps. I ran into him one time. I hadn't seen him in several years. And I said, "Do you remember Bill?" And I gave a last name. And he said, "If anybody you sponsor ever commits suicide, you'll always remember them." And I said, "Jerry, I'm scared. I can't find the differences between me and Bill." When I was sober 2 years, he was too. He and I had the same sobriety date, plus or minus a month or two, and I'm not sure which was what, but it was right in there together. And so we had the same home group where I saw him 5 to 8 times a week. We had the same sponsor, you. And he drove home 2 years sober from a meeting one night, pulled in the garage and dropped the door and left it running and committed suicide sober. And I can't find the difference between me and him, and I'm scared. What was the difference, Jerry? And he said, "I could not get him to do a 4-step, and he died of resentment." And I thought about it. I've talked to others who knew us in that era who agree. I've had this conversation with them, and they agree. Bill could not, every time you saw him, he could not wait to run up to you and tell you what some SOB had just done to him. He was the perennial victim. And it's my experience that the victims don't get sober. And he would not lay it down. He would not lay it down. He was in love with his resentments, and he would not lay it down. And it killed him. As Jerry's analysis, I think it was accurate. So what we're going to talk about now, what we're beginning now, is a sales pitch on the forgiveness process. That's what we're coming to here. We found that it is fatal. I want you to know I witnessed that. I've seen it more than once. I'm just going to use that example. That's twice we threatened your life. For when harboring such feelings, it doesn't say when having such feelings. It says when harboring. I think I'm okay if I have a resentment if I'm not harboring it. We're going to tell me how not to harbor it in a few minutes. Harbor means to give a safe place to nurture. For when harboring such feelings, we shut ourselves off from the sunlight of the Spirit. The insanity of alcohol returns and we drink again. With us, to drink is to... 3. If we were to live, once again, only for the ones that want to live, that's 4. We had to be free of anger. The grouch and the brainstorm were not for us. About the time this book was being written, a very creative man named Walt Disney sat his staff down and came up with a concept where they would spit out ideas together to write Mickey Mouse cartoons. And he labeled his process brainstorming. That is not what we're talking about. I found a dictionary from the 1930s and looked up brainstorm. And what it says has nothing to do with creativity. It says transient, violent, mental outburst. We know that as rage. So there are two kinds of anger. There's the grouch or the slow burn and the brainstorm, detonation, the rage. If we were to live, we had to be free of anger. The grouch and the brainstorm were not for us. Boy, is this thin. They may be the dubious luxury of normal men. But for alcoholics, these things are poison. Five. What happens when you take poison? Yeah. We turned back to the list, for it held the key to the future. Excuse me, does that mean if I don't find the key to the future, I won't have a future? Yes, sir. That's precisely what that means. That's 6. We just threatened your life again. We were prepared to look at it from an entirely different angle. Different from what? Well, the last time we looked at the list was actually the bottom of the preceding page, the last sentence, where it says, the first thing apparent was that this world and people were often quite wrong. We've been making observations about resentment since then. We have not even talked about our list. So now we have to prepare to look at it from an entirely different angle. I thought I was going to say, now we're going to look for my part. It never says that. I think it's one of the most frequent misquotes in this book, and it is so incorrect. Forgive me, that's real judgmental, but that's how I feel about it. We're going to talk about that in a couple of minutes. It never tells me to look for my part. But first thing it tells me, it says, we began to see that the world as people really dominated us. So I want him now, in one of these 30-minute periods, to sit and go down the list and we'll see how this dominated you. I talked about my father and how that still sometimes dominates me. How did these things dominate you? Have they changed your life to date? While that was going on, did you plan your life so you'd be around them in case they screwed up, you'd make sure everybody knew it? Or did you plan your life so you'd never be anywhere near them so they couldn't get you again? Did you squander the hours by laying awake at night and hate them? How did these things dominate you? We've asked you to take a look at that. And then it says in that state, that's the state of being dominated by these resentments, the wrongdoings of others, fancied or real. Oh, you mean some of this only happened in my head? That's exactly what we mean. Had the power to actually kill. Oh, seven. We just threatened your life for the seventh time on this page. How could we escape? We saw that these resentments must be mastered. Time out. They saw that. Do you? Have we made our sale? But how? We could not wish them away any more than alcohol. I'm a commissioned salesman by trade. That's what I do for a living. That's what Bill did, and I don't claim to speak for him. This is one of the best sales pitches I've ever seen. A good salesman will never mention price until he's established value. We have just threatened your life seven times. Was that good enough? Are you convinced that it really doesn't matter what the price is? You must have these things gone. Are you convinced? I hope so, because the price is high. We're going to ask you to do some things you are not going to like. And that doesn't upset us a bit. I want you to know that. It says, this was our course. We realized that the people who wronged us were perhaps spiritually sick. My great mentor defined spiritually sick as cut off from God. To have done those things that I did, I had to turn my back on God. It says, we realized. Another one, look at me for a second. My other teacher says, I realized. I can know something, but when I realize it, it becomes real for me on a different level. My wife calls it heart knowledge. And I must now realize that the people who wronged me were perhaps spiritually sick. I'm not going to call on anybody, but I want you now to bring into your mind the one or two worst things you ever did, ever. Got them? Weren't you spiritually sick to have done those things? Had you been walking in the sunlight of the Spirit, in conscious contact with this gentle, loving God that created the galaxies and the duck-billed platypus and all that, everything in between, could you have done that? Could you have done that? I don't think so. Would you have thought of doing it? Probably not. Were you spiritually sick? I was spiritually sick when I did the things that I did that repulsed me now. Yeah. And so I have got to grant that to them. And I have them pray the list one at a time. We're still doing these 30-minute segments. And I have them pray the list now. First name on the list, Fred. God, please help me realize, that Fred is just spiritually sick and not an SOB. And I have them at this point in that 5-minute segment to begin with, talk to God about the two or three worst things you ever did and how sad you are about it and how ashamed and how you crave his forgiveness and ask him to help you with this process. It's a pretty good perspective. When I got here, my sponsor told me this was my situation. Now, he was so right. He said, what you want is mercy for you and justice for everybody else. And the package is mercy for everybody or justice for everybody, and you are part of everybody, and you get to choose. And I'm in no position to face justice. None. I have therefore chosen mercy for everybody, including those who have harmed me. I have chosen mercy for them because it's the only way I can get it for myself. Have them pray that list once, top of page 67. And I feed these directions one at a time, too. Never this much. Though we did not like their symptoms, that's a symptom of their spiritual sickness, which is what they did that left me with a resentment. And the way these disturbed us, that is my resentment, they, like ourselves, were sick, too. This is so important, they've told me twice in two sentences that they were sick too. And says, we ask God, that sounds like a prayer to me. We ask God to help us show them the same tolerance, pity, and patience that we were cheerfully granted a sick friend. I have very prayerfully approached this because several of my mentors got sober on the second edition. And I want to move back into the more will be disclosed section. One of my other favorite misquotes is more will be revealed. Can you tell me what page it's on? I didn't think so. Let's take a look at page 551. This is in the story of freedom from bondage. There's some powerful information here. I recommend the stories. Last paragraph, bottom of page 551. And I'm in a fourth edition. If you're in a third, it's the bottom of 552, I believe. It says, top of 552. One morning, however, I realized I had to get rid of it. This is a resentment against her mother. She says, for my reprieve, if you look up reprieve in your dictionary, it's a stay of execution. This is another death threat. For my reprieve was running out, and I didn't want to, and if I didn't get rid of it, I was going to get drunk, and I didn't want to get drunk anymore. In my prayers that morning, I asked God to point out to me some way to be free of this resentment. During the day, a friend of mine, brought me some magazines to take to a hospital group I was interested in. I looked through them. A banner across one featured an article by a prominent clergyman in which I caught the word resentment. I want to observe the sequence of events here, because I think it's a predictable sequence of events. Item one, she sees something about herself that needs work or needs to be changed. Please notice I didn't say something was wrong with her. I don't think there's anything wrong with us. We're God's kids. There are things about us that could use some work. It's a different mindset. She sees something about herself that needs some work. She prays about it. Now, I like to add, talk to my sponsor or somebody else. She didn't do that here, apparently. And then what does she do? She got focused helping somebody else. She's taking magazines into a hospital. She's doing something for somebody else, and her answer fell out of the sky on her. And I would propose that that's a predictable series of events. And when I see it with the men I sponsor, I always point at it. All right, you had something that needed work. You prayed about it. You talked to me about it. You got focused taking meetings into the jails. And you came out, and your answer was laying on the hood of the car. It's a predictable sequence of events. It happens all the time. Staying focused on the problem doesn't help me a bit. Page 552 at the top, he said, in effect, if you have a resentment you want to be free of, oh, that's a good question. Did we make our sale? Do you want to be free of it? If you will pray for the person or thing that you resent, you will be free. If you will ask in prayer for everything you want for yourself to be given to them, you'll be free. Ask for their health, their prosperity, their happiness, and you'll be free. Even when you don't really want it for them and your prayers are only words and you don't mean it, go ahead and do it anyway. Now, it goes on to say that'll work in 2 weeks. That has not been my experience. I mean, this lady was pretty spiritually evolved. She's down to one. I'm working with you. You've got about 162 resentments. A pretty good guess of where we're starting. Some of the younger people have a smaller number. The highest number I've ever seen was over 500, and I thought that list was incomplete. This guy hated everybody, and he wished there was more of them. And yeah, we see that every now and again. With that prayer in the back of the book, what I'm doing is I'm praying for the other person. So it would look something like this. God, I pray that Fred gets promoted at work, that he has a big spiritual experience and walks in the sunlight of the Spirit, that his kids go to school in scholarship, that he wins the Tennessee lottery, that his wife is a fabulous lover, that his lawn grows lush and green, but it grows so slowly he only has to mow it once a year. Just hanging out over the edge, just whatever you can think of that you'd like to have. And so that's praying for them. And then this prayer on 67, we ask God, help me show him the same tolerance, pity, and patience I would cheerfully grant a sick friend. And pray that. First name on the list. Pray it. 30-minute session. Pray it. Once. And now you ask yourself a simple question. Do I mean it? It's not an essay question. That's a yes or no. If the answer is no, go to the next name. Don't stay there. If the answer is yes, put a check mark and go to the next name. And when you get to the end of the list, we'll just start and pray it again. Just the ones that don't have check marks. And I really don't care how long this takes. The last one I took to this work took right at 4 months. And I had him doing it 3 30-minute sessions a week, and whenever he was driving his car or in the shower or had 5 minutes. And I think it's so critically important to dig this part of the poison out of my soul. We pray a prayer at the end of a lot of these meetings. It has a phrase in it. It says, forgive us our trespasses as we forgive those who trespass against us. I think what that says is, God, if I don't forgive them, don't you forgive me. And yet I find myself without the power to forgive. I used to say it all the time. You know, I forgive you. Oh, you'd be smart enough to turn your back on me. I forgive you. Yeah. See, I don't know how to do that. I can't change me. I can't change me. If I could have changed me, we'd have probably never met. What I can change are my actions this day. And therein lies a tremendous amount of power. That's where the action is for me. It's always in today, and what can I do? And I hold them there for a pretty good period of time. Sometimes we get to one that just won't move. And we have to get into step 9 before that one frees up. And I have permission, by the way, and so does Bob, to tell any stories we tell. I sponsor a man whose son was murdered. And I'm not going to give any more details on that. I'll give you a hint. It was the lead story on CNN for a week on 2 or 3 different occasions. I didn't think we'd ever get this thing finished. And he just couldn't let go of it. But he was able to when he got into step 9. And he got the forgiveness as he made his amends. And I can't explain that, but he does very beautifully, and I know Lee's got it on CD. He knows what I'm talking about. But generally, I hold them there till we're done. And what happens is they all report the same thing. I feel different. I feel like I don't weigh as much as I weigh. My body feels lighter. I laugh more often. I'm having a better time. It's amazing as we dig this poison out of our soul. And I say it this way. To me, resentment is like ice around my heart. And the ice has a thickness, I think, based on how serious the events were and how often they happened and how much I have nurtured the resentment. And what I do here is I hold the icy heart up to the sunlight of the Spirit. And sunlight will melt ice, depending maybe on the thickness of the ice and how close I can hold it and how long and how often. Eventually it will melt. And I will find that I really do hope that these people I used to just absolutely hate, I hope they do great. I hope they have a big spiritual experience, and I just hope their lives go super. I think that in my own experience, the English language has it wrong. We use the verb forgive as a transitive verb, as something that I can do. Like I can give you this piece of paper, but I can't forgive you. When I've forgiven you, I haven't done something, I've received something. So this is about me opening up to receive the gift of not hating you anymore. And this is the only thing I've ever seen that would do that. And I'd like to observe we haven't written anything here for a very long time. Step four is not about writing, although there's writing involved. We wrote so that we could make observations. We observe so we know what to pray. It is in the observations and prayers that the changes happen. Continuing on page 67. So here are my marching orders from now on. When a person offended, we said to ourselves, this is a sick man, how can I be helpful to him? God save me from being angry. There's another prayer. Thy will be done. So as we said to ourselves, so that means I don't say that out loud to him. And then it says, we avoid retaliation or argument. We wouldn't treat sick people that way. If we do, we destroy our chance of being helpful. Page 77, what are we really doing here? Third line. Our real purpose is to fit ourselves to be of maximum service to God and the people about us. I misread that for a long time. Somebody cleared it. They added a word in this thing just about a year ago. You know what I mean? They sneak into your bedroom at night and they change the book. Does anybody else know what I'm talking about? Yeah, well, this is a recent change. I think they ought to put something in the grapevine about it when they do, but they don't. All right, third line. It says our real purpose is to fit ourselves to be of maximum, not to be of maximum service. That's not my assignment. My assignment is to fit myself to be of maximum service. Right. The craftsman used is the best tool that's at hand. My job isn't to be used. My job is to be the best tool I can be. Back on 67. So I can't afford to destroy my chance of being helpful because the book is full of I got to be helpful. It says we cannot be helpful to all people, but at least God, here's a promise, will show us how to take a kindly and tolerant view of each and every one. Can you imagine that with the people who have harmed you greatly? I have that in place. It's amazing. I got a guy that beat me out of $500,000. It's probably not a lot of money to you. It's a pretty good bit to me. And I don't ever think about it. And nothing happened in here when I just said that. I use it as an example. I went through this process. And he walks in here now. God bless him and I wish him the best. We go to lunch. I'm not mad anymore. I have been changed. I didn't forgive him. I received the gift of not hating him anymore. Referring to our list again, putting out of our minds the wrongs others had done, how are you going to do that if you still hate them? You got somebody you hate. How are you going to think about them and not think about what they did to you? I don't think so. We resolutely look for our own mistakes. It does not say I look for my part. And I want to talk about the major difference between my part and my mistake. If I'm looking for my part, I'm saying somebody else has a part. Bob is going to illuminate that for you in a couple of minutes. What I'm looking for is my mistakes. What did I do wrong? In many cases, as a child, I was abused. I didn't do anything wrong as a child. What I did wrong was carry that hatred that long. That was a bad mistake. I sponsor a man who was sexually abused by a deacon of a church in the church from the time he was 6 until he was about 11. And I tell you, I have permission to tell this. And he said one of the mistakes he did was it made him a very angry man. He made a decision about age 12. Nobody's ever going to put their hands on him again. And he became a very violent man. And part of his mistake was becoming violent and doing all that harm in their name, which is really what it was. So what were my mistakes? He said, where had we been? Selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, and frightened. That list is all over this book. And these are the earmarks of the emergence of self. Selfish, I want my way. Dishonest, I don't care what the price is. I want my way. Self-seeking, clear enough. Frightened, afraid I won't get my way in the future. Let's take a look at just a few other pages where that list is. It's on page 84 in step 10, about 12 lines from the bottom. continue to watch for selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear. That sounds vaguely familiar. Top of page 86. First full paragraph. When we retire at night, we constructively review our day. Were we resentful, selfish, dishonest, or afraid? Page 88. Second line. Slightly different list, but pretty much the same. We are then in much less danger of excitement, fear, anger, worry, self-pity, or foolish decisions. Page 145. You have an enemy. Did you know that? They're going to tell us about it. Paragraph begins in the center of page 145. The greatest enemies of us alcoholics are resentment, jealousy, envy, frustration, and fear. The list varies. Let's go back to 67. But it's all over the book. And all of those things are the earmarks of the reemergence of self. They all have to do with self. That's self is in the front again. All right. Though situation had not been entirely our fault, we tried to disregard the other person involved entirely. Again, if I still hate him, I can't do that. Where were we to blame? The inventory was ours, not the other man's. We saw our faults, we listed them, we placed them before us in black and white. I think there are an awful lot of right ways to do that paragraph. My great mentor did it in sentence form. I've seen another one of my teachers make a simple list on a separate sheet. I'm a fourth column kind of guy. Because I think if I do it as a fourth column, step eight pretty well takes care of itself when I get to it. That's just whatever your sponsor says suits me fine. I think your sponsor's right. But it's important that we get this stuff down on paper and have a look at it. And then it says, we admitted our wrongs honestly and we're willing to set these matters straight. See, that sounds like step eight to me. I think we're going to find something very similar a little bit later on in step four. I think four and eight have an awful lot in common. I'm going to go ahead and run just a couple of minutes. I'm going to do just a couple little pieces on fear, and then we're going to take a break. Bob's going to pick it up. Turning to page 68, just take my word for it. The bottom of 67 says fear is bad news. And, it says we reviewed our fears thoroughly, put them on paper, even though we had no resentment connection with them. So I got two kinds of fear for this purpose, the ones that have a resentment connected and the ones that don't. It says we asked ourselves why we had them. I will be forever grateful, they told me. Why? Because I had no idea. Said, wasn't it because self-reliance failed us? And have a list of fears. And I got in a discussion one time with a guy, and he said he looked both ways before he crossed the street because he had a fear of getting run over by a bus. I'm not saying he doesn't have busophobia. He might have. I look both ways before I cross the street because I intuitively know it's in my best interest to do so. Fear is something that grips me here. Fear is when I reach into the basket and throw the cobra down here near the front row. That's fear. So I ask myself what I have them, and the fact is I have them because I'm not God-reliant. If you can ask yourself this question going down your fear list, were I totally God-reliant, would I have this fear? And the answer is no for me in all cases. Next paragraph, we think there's a better way. For we are now at a different basis, the basis of trusting and relying upon God. Roman numeral 16, front of the book, way toward the front, forward to the second edition. Powerful information. XBI. It's the second page of the forward of the second edition. Bill Wilson is about to leave the Oxford groups, and he's going to take some of what they've got. He's not going to take it all. He's going to take some of it. About eight lines down. Though he could not accept all the tenets of the Oxford groups, he was convinced of the need for moral inventory, confession of personality defects, restitution to those harmed. That would be different from an apology, I suppose. Helpfulness to others. There that is again. And the necessity, I wonder how important that is, the necessity of belief in and dependence upon God. Look at me for a second. Belief in God and dependence upon God are separate concepts. I got here like most people, afraid there might be a God, thinking there was a God, and not having a higher power. That's pretty common. Page 68. Perhaps there is a better way, we think so, for we are now on a different basis. The basis of trusting and relying upon God. We trust infinite God rather than our finite selves. We're in the world to play the role He assigns. Step 1, Section B. My life's unmanageable. I'm here to play the role He assigns. I love the story that God created this particular animal, and He gave this animal a hunger only for the leaves that grew at the very top of a particular kind of tree. And He also gave the giraffe a long neck so He could get to him. I have a long neck for God's will for me. I quote my wife who says, God's will, it's a good deal. I've been scared of it all my life. Now, Mama, why did Grandma die? Well, it was God's will. Sounded dangerous to me. I had to take, when I got here, the words God's will. What does that mean? Break it into two pieces. Here's the first one. What am I going to be when I grow up? Where am I going to live? How much money am I going to make? What's going to happen to my children? And do the communists eventually take over the world? And all of that stuff. And every bit of that violates one day at a time. I now think of that whole concept as God's plan. Step 1, Section B says, I'm not management. Consequently, I don't need to know what the plan is. Leaves me with God's will. So what's God's will? This is just me. What's God's will for me? I'm married. I act like a married man all the time. I've got some kids. I'm trying to be a good dad. I drive a car. I let you in traffic. I have an employer. I give them a good day's work. I'm an alcoholic. I have a home group. I take meetings into the jail. I've done the steps. I sponsor some guys. I got a sponsor. I'm a child of God. I pray. I meditate. I'm a citizen. I vote. I'm going to tell you how I vote, too. I vote by secret ballot. And I hope you do, too. And I hope we don't ever cross that line around here, anywhere near an AA meeting. You kill somebody. If you're on one side politically and a new guy walks up and he's on the other, here's a discussion, you could kill him. He could turn around and walk away and die. All right? I know God's will for me is to act like one of his kids. I'm a child of God. I'm not an adult of God. You know, I always wanted to be God's coach. Hey, big fella, take a knee. You know, and I've got this shopping list. I've got a close friend who says his sponsor told him at 6 months, he says, I'm really glad that you want to serve God. I am sorry, however, that you only want to serve in an advisory capacity. Prayer is not a chance for me to change God's mind. It's a chance for him to change mine. I had so many things backwards when I got here. Continuing here on page, wherever we are, 68. So I'm in the world to play the role he assigns, and I'm going to do one more sentence, and I'm going to quit. Just to the extent that we do as we think he would have us and humbly rely on him, does he enable us to match calamity with serenity? It's permission to make a mistake. Just as I do as I think he would have me. I don't always know. If I'm trying to do what I think God wants me to do, I still make mistakes, but I make a much finer quality of mistake today than I ever made before. We have a name for that. It's progress. Right? I think there are two definitions for progress. One is making the same old mistake a little less often. Think about it. That's progress. Or making a new and finer quality mistake. That's progress. We're going to take a 13-minute break. Carolyn, I'm an alcoholic. Stop. Welcome back. Are we having fun yet? There's some questions up here. One of them is, why isn't there more questions? But there are some questions up here. And if you'd like to put a question up here, like Scott said, which is really true, you'll get experience and dumb looks probably, but we'll see, something will come out of it. Step 4, turn me around. I wouldn't be here if it wasn't for the 4th step as it's outlined in the book. And yet I didn't do it when I first got sober. When I first got sober, I hit such a tremendous bottom with alcoholism that I was so scared that I spent my first 4 years of sobriety doing everything in service you can do in Alcoholics Anonymous. I did H&I. I went on 12-step calls. I was on every committee, every general service position, from GSR all the way up to area officer. Intergroup convention positions and every position on convention, 2 different convention committees, almost as if I was trying to outrun my alcoholism. And at 4 years sober, it caught up with me. And I got to that place where I was in trouble. And I found this paragraph in the 12x12, and this is really a description of exactly where I'm at. And if you're sitting here, and if you relate to even a third of this, then maybe you're in a spot where there's some inventory work that has to be needed to be done. And I'll tell you, at 4 years of sobriety, I had already done 2 4-steps. But I hadn't done what it talks about in our book. My first one was 40 pages of everything I felt ashamed of, my life story, right? And my second one
was trying to answer the 30-some questions in essay format from the 12x12 in step four. And I got to tell you, neither one of those really changed very much in here. The first one, I got rid of some secrets, but nothing had really changed. And so what happens is my alcoholism is overcoming me. I can't outrun them. There's not enough meetings anymore to make me okay, really. And I found this paragraph, and this is comes from the 12x12 in step five, and it's talking about the symptoms of untreated alcoholism where you've missed something in the inventory process, in the house cleaning process. And here's what it says. It says, some people are unable to stay sober at all. Others will relapse periodically until they really clean house. Even AA old-timers, sober for years, often pay dearly for skimping this step. And at 4 years, I figured I was an old-timer. They will tell how they tried to carry the load alone. At that point in my life, I'll tell you, everything was heavy. It was a big deal. I mean, it was overwhelming. One of the clubs, someone accused me of having my sense of humor surgically removed. I mean, there's, you know, a big deal here. And then this next symptom, it says how much they suffered of irritability. I'm that guy that is just so easily annoyed by everybody, from traffic to what people are sharing in meetings to the person with 13 items in the 12 item or less line. I know I counted it twice, right? You know, and I'm just so irritated, and everybody rubs me the wrong way. I become the real judgmental guy again. The guy who's just looking for stuff. How I suffered from anxiety. I used to wake up afraid. And I don't know why or what of. Just wake up with that apprehensive, anxious edge to me. Wake up in my head with a sense of something's like I have to really pay attention because something bad is going to happen. I love that phrase, the feeling of impending doom. I really understood. And that's why I had that sense. It's a very low-level thing, but it's just a sense of apprehension. How they suffered from remorse. Because when you're irritable and know what's wrong with everybody and anxious, you end up telling them about it. And and you feel bad about the confrontation. And I was trying to get these little confrontations in restaurants with waiters, and they wouldn't wait on me quickly enough, or people after meetings as I'd try to straighten them out because they didn't share properly, or whatever the craziness is going on with me, right? And then every time I do that and I get in a confrontation, or maybe it's at work with my boss or one of the other employees or a customer, I always feel bad afterwards. You know why? You know why I feel remorseful? Probably for the same reason you are, that you do. Because I become the guy that I don't like. I don't like people that are that way. And so I've become the guy I don't like. Of course I have remorse and I don't feel good about myself. And how we suffered, the next symptom is depression. And I struggled with depression. It looks like clinical depression, but it's not. That's why we're often misdiagnosed. And I'm not saying that there aren't occasionally people end up in Alcoholics Anonymous with legitimate clinical depression. But my depression is not clinical. It's spiritual. It's the depression of the obsessively overly self-involved. I just get so much of me on me, I start feeling smothered. Right, I'm just on me. And how unconsciously seeking relief, they would sometimes accuse even their best friends of the very character defects they themselves were trying to conceal. I heard this years ago, a guy who's passed on, who was a wonderful member of AA, he was talking, the subject was inventory at a participation meeting, and he said, it's very simple for me. If I want to know how I'm doing spiritually, I just look around me. And if everybody I see seems to be doing okay, not perfect, but struggling with a lot of the same stuff I struggle with? He says, I'm usually okay. But if I look around and I see a lot of idiots that really need to straighten out, he says, I'm in a lot of trouble. And that's really true. And a lot of my experiences with step four in the resentment and the fear section are very similar to Scott's. One of the things that I don't know if this is true with women as much as men. I think to some degree it probably is. But I know, because I only sponsor guys, so I know experience with working with guys, is that a lot of guys, we're so disconnected from our resentments that we don't even believe we have them. Because some guys don't want to even admit to themselves that other people could actually hurt us. And about five to six years ago, a guy that was sober 23 years came to me and asked me to sponsor him. And he was 23 years sober with the benefit of step none. And he was wound up and brisk. And he had been thinking about drinking, and he had been thinking about killing himself because he knows drinking's not an answer. And he's not so much he's going to drink. He wants relief, and he doesn't know what to do. And suicide's starting to look like a serious piece of business in his life. And it was a last-ditch effort. He'd been watching me for a number of years, and he came to me and asked me if I would sponsor him and help him. And I told him I would. I said, yeah, it'd be my pleasure. And we started through this journey, and we'd finished the third step, and he came to me one night, and he's an old ex-Navy chief, kind of a gruff, one of those uptight guys, the kind of guy that just looks like he's about to explode on somebody at any second. Real time, he holds his arms like this, grim face. So I said to him, I said, I want you to make a list of all the people you resent. He goes, I don't have any resentments. Nobody gets to me. I said, really? I mean, you could watch this guy walk across a parking lot from 100 yards and know he's uptight about something. I mean, I said, really? He said, no, I just let it go. Don't bother me. Whoa. So I said something. This was kind of an intuitive thing. I said, okay. I said, listen, in your case, I don't want you to make a list of resentments. Why don't you make a list of people you feel smugly superior to? And he got this look like, oh, is that going to be a long list? Right? Because what is my resentment list? Isn't it my judgment list? On the top of page 64, it says, though our decision, step three, was a vital and crucial step, it could have little permanent effect unless at once followed by a strenuous effort to face and be rid of the things which had been blocking us. I'm blocked a couple ways. I'm blocked from God, the God it talks about that is deep down within me, the great reality. I'm disconnected and I'm cut off from that. And I'm blocked from carrying out the decision in step three. I can say the words. I can have the intention of letting God have my will in my life. But that doesn't mean I'm able to carry it out and give it to Him. I'm blocked from doing it. And I'm blocked from other people. I think alcoholics live in a peculiar state of separation that really, and I didn't get this until I did this fourth step, this really is initiated by my judgment of others. Usually the self-centered fear judgments of people, and I put people like this, because I'm afraid. And so I'm blocked from God, I'm blocked from other people to a state of painful loneliness, and I'm blocked from carrying out the decision in step three, so I keep sabotaging my own life, sober. But other than that, I'm really all right, I guess. I'm a mess. So I start on this process because I need to dismantle and surrender all my judgments. And what I discovered in this, to my amazement, that the exact nature of my wrongs was not the guy I stabbed and the money I stole and on the sleazy things I did. That's all on there. It's part of my 8-step list. And a lot of those shameful things that really went under my fear inventory because I was afraid someone would find out, or I was afraid of retribution or bad karma, or I was afraid of never getting over it, or I was afraid of never forgiving myself. But that's not really the exact nature. The exact nature is how wrong I had been when I went over my resentment list, how wrong I'd been about my mother and father. I never looked, gave them a fair shake. I never gave them the fair shake that I wanted other people to give me. See, I'm great for wanting you to understand me, but I'd never give you 10 seconds to try to understand you. I got my demands and my will and my judgments, and when you don't meet up to them, you feel the wrath of Bob in this effort to play God. So when I got to that part that Scott was talking about, this was our course. This was really the part that turned me around so dramatically. As I started to really connect the dots within me about how I'm like the people that had hurt me, and I started to see myself in them and really get it, and I start to understand how if I had all the fears going on inside of me that were going on inside of you, if I'd been raised like you were raised, if I was my spirit and sense of myself was as sick and twisted and driven as yours is, can I get it, really get it, that I could have easily, under those conditions, done to someone else what they'd done to me? And when I started to do that, what happened is I started to really see myself in these people. And what I was seeing is that's me. This guy I hate and I churn about in my head and want vengeance towards, that's me. Now it's me maybe on a really bad day, but it's me. That I'm not smugly superior. And it's funny how every resentment has within the core of the judgment, the ego has this smugly superior sense. As if, you think to yourself, I'm not like them. I'd never do something like that. As if you're so much all of that, right? But I'll tell you what I learned about me, and it's the truth, is that I'm absolutely, absolutely capable, under the right set of circumstances, to doing to another human being whatever another human being has ever done to another human being. And if I haven't done certain things, it's more about circumstances than it is about virtue. I just have never been driven by those insane fears. And I have never been, my personality and my emotions never tweaked me at the right time, at the right place like it did. I do meetings in prisons. I see guys that have been there and committed murder. I've seen them that have done crazy stuff, robbed, did desperate, desperado moves. And in talking to these guys, it's rare that I ever run into someone that when they start to tell me about the circumstances of what happened where I can't say, oh man, that could have been me. There was a guy in California, died a few years ago. If you ever get a chance to hear Norm A's tapes, he's an amazing speaker. Norm used to say, alcoholism's a disease of seconds and inches. The difference between the guy doing life imprisonment and me is that I went through the intersection 5 seconds after, been at 5 seconds sooner, and those people would have been dead. I got out of there 3 minutes before the cops arrived. I did just this much less than the guy who overdosed. It's seconds and it's inches. And yet how often I would go about my life and watch other people die and feel like as if I'm all of that, and that could never happen to me. Yes, it could. And I started, this is really where I started to claim my real inheritance in God, in the realm of the Spirit. And I think in the realm of the Spirit, when you get there, what you realize is that we're all one here. I think what Einstein said may be true, that the great illusion of mankind is that there's more than one of us here. You really start to get that when you start sponsoring people and you start listening to fifth steps and you start realizing it. I don't know when you realize it. I don't know if it's after your 20th fifth step you hear or your 100th, but somewhere in the process of doing that, you start to get that it's the same person. There's nothing different here. It's the same person. I've been waiting for something new for 25 years. I haven't heard nothing new in a fifth step in 25 years. I'd like something new. You know, like chunky peanut butter and a vibrating lawn rake. Something creative. I mean, it's always the same pathetic, scared, vacant, driven, judgmental, childish person stepping on the toes of everyone around them in this futile, vain effort to make themselves better. It's the same story. It never changes. Never changes. And this is where I started to claim my community. And there's a prayer in there. Scott talked about it very eloquently. It's where I'm asking God to help me to show them the same patience, which means to demonstrate towards them, to act towards them with the same patience, pity, and tolerance that I would cheerfully grant a sick friend. You know what that guy did? What if I found out he had a brain tumor that drove him to do that? Man, I'd think a lot different about him. And I'll tell you, there's a dynamic that I've noticed with some consistency in the realm of the Spirit, that when prayer meets action of anticipation to God's hand, miracles start to incredible.